The following episode of FOFOP is rated MA. It contains alternating hosts, a rotating roster of guests, and mild coarse language. FOFOP advises that it is not suitable for anyone under the age of 15, or anyone who came here looking for one of those highbrow NPR-type podcasts. Minors must be accompanied by a parent or guardian. This is John Deek speaking.
Hello and welcome to FOFOP. I'm Charlie Clawson and my guest this week is journalist, film critic and host of the podcast Four Finger Discount, which I forgot to mention last time. It was a huge faux pas on my part. Guy Davis, welcome back to the show. May I add, welcome back by popular demand. Our first installment video store in which we reminisced about films of the 90s really struck a chord with people, and I was inundated with messages from people saying, hey, can you get Guy back on? Can you do a separate film podcast? And I was like, you know what? That was fun. Let's do it again. Why wait?
This has done my ego a world of good, Charlie. So thank you very much for that. And thank you very much for having me back. I had a blast last time, and I hope we can repeat it this time around.
Well, I like all good producers, I'm stealing content. This is not my idea. You actually put a tweet out a few days ago, which I thought was an intriguing premise, which was, if you could improve one film by 25%, what would that film be? And I thought it was such a great question, because there are those films that you go and see and you're like, oh, like it's either they didn't stick the landing, or if only they'd cast this person instead of that person. And there's all these elements which doesn't necessarily mean you dislike the film, but you just feel like you could be really proud of the film. You could really like sell it to people if it wasn't for that missing quarter.
It elevates it from guilty pleasure to genuine pleasure. And a lot of people really take issue with the term guilty pleasure. I mean, they say, oh no, look, if you like it, just like it. Don't revel in your enjoyment of it. But when I use the term guilty pleasure, it's exactly in that way. It's like, this is so close to being really, really good, and I'm still enjoying it, but I can see the flaws, I can see the faults, and I know how to fix them.
Yeah.
Let me do it. So, yeah, that's my definition of a guilty pleasure.
And it's also
I think that's what we'll be talking about this time around. I mean, I think the list you've given me, these look like pretty enjoyable movies.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you've got a couple that I have not seen. And in my very brief research, I'm like, I'm intrigued to find out how it's only 25% you think it's needed.
Honestly, I think that quantity is going to vary quite dramatically in some cases.
I'm excited to have you back on, because I only recently have ventured back into the cinema. You know, my daughter was born about 2 years ago, and as most parents know, in that first 2 years, the cinema is a luxury you cannot afford unless you're being paid to go there, which I am not. And so I don't know if it's just because I've been deprived of the cinematic experience for so long, but I have loved the first two films I've gone back to see. So I saw Last Night in Soho last week, and then I saw the new Bond film on Sunday. And I am not a Bond fan. Like I understand and I appreciate the affection people have for Bond films, but I don't really get the campiness of the 60s ones, the kind of ridiculousness of the Pierce Brosnan era. I saw Casino Royale and I was enjoying it right up until the moment he gets whacked in the nuts with a giant rope. And I'm like, what the fuck is this? Is this escapist, or is this like suddenly we're straying into kind of like hard-boiled territory? But I got to say, have you seen the new No Time to Die?
I've seen No Time to Die, yeah. And I think you have to sort of be across the whole Craig body of work to sort of get it. I mean, I think if you're walking into No Time to Die without having seen Spectre, the one that immediately preceded it, you might be going, okay, who's this now? And why is he here? And what now?
Well, I am someone who has not kept up. I think I saw Quantum of Solace. I can't remember. Is that the one where Venice falls into the water?
I think that's the end of Casino Royale.
Oh, okay. Well, that was the last Craig Bond film I saw. So I came into this one pretty cold. But I think that it's almost the opposite. I think that this is a great film to see if you are not a Bond fan, because it's the way, and, you know, we'll dance around spoilers, but he has things at stake in this movie which make it more compelling. And I think it's kind of the reason maybe I'm not a Bond fan in the previous films, because it is also meaningless in the end, you know, like especially the older films where it's just the babes and the cars. I'm like, yeah, this is fun, but it doesn't really resonate with me.
Well, I think, you know, traditionally a James Bond movie is like a 2.5 hour holiday for a middle-aged white guy.
Yeah.
You know, it's like you walk out thinking, you know, what if I spent a few bucks in a decent wardrobe and learned how to mix a decent cocktail? I too could live that life.
But as a cinema, as a film, like as a bit of cinema, like Cary Fukunaga is such a really, really good director. And it looks beautiful. I don't know if it's just like the lack of travel from COVID or whatever, but all those locations were so mouthwatering and so beautifully shot and so crisp. And you realize how we've been inundated with so many kind of action movies over the years that are made cheaply or at a, you know, bridge schedule. And so the action is hard to follow, or it's shaky cam or it's low light because they have to cut corners and conceal things and stuff. But this is old school, big budget Hollywood filmmaking where, like, I mean, I know this is not a new observation, but the wardrobe, like Daniel Craig's outfits, fantastic. Like, I'm telling you, like, I want to look as good as the guy saving the world. Like, that last outfit he's got where it's like the braces over the fisherman pants.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, you're right about Fukunaga at the helm of this one. I mean, the guy's clearly got a beautiful eye for visual, a great eye for composition and all that kind of stuff. The action's incredibly coherent. It's not, as you say, it's not all shaky cam, not all rushed. You know what's going on. You know what's at stake. And what you mentioned about stakes is very, very important as well. This has a really hefty emotional component to it.
Yeah,
which, as we say, no spoilers. Although I think if you say no spoilers now, people start going.
They start guessing at the spoilers.
They start, they do.
Well, the other film, Last Night in Soho, Edgar Wright, is part of the reason I thought this was a good subject to talk about, because it is a film that I really enjoyed, but I walked away going, oh, it could have been better. And then I started thinking about that, because when you put that tweet out, I responded with Scott Pilgrim. And then another friend of mine, Alex Williams, chimed in. He couldn't believe, because, you know, he's of a generation that reveres Scott Pilgrim. And look, let me get this out of the way. Edgar Wright is a fantastic filmmaker, no question, and a unique, original voice who creates his own work, you know, very rarely adapts other material apart from like Scott Pilgrim, and is an important member of the film community. But I reckon, apart from Shaun of the Dead, he has not done one other home run. Like, all of his films have been admirable in different areas and enjoyable. The Cornetto trilogy is enjoyable, but to me, Shaun of the Dead is almost perfect. It's a perfect film. Yet I feel with these other ones, like he's reaching for something and doesn't quite get there. Or what I feel he does, and it's definitely true of Last Night in Soho, is he falls back on convention. He's so film literate that I think he's like, well, you know, this is, you know, my favorite Italian horror director, so I'm just going to reference a bit of this. Or, you know, this is an obscure Asian, so I'm going to... It's that Tarantino thing, whereas Tarantino still makes it feel like something unique in his own, whereas Edgar Wright, I still feel like, I don't know what you're referencing, but I know you're referencing something.
Yeah. I think with Tarantino especially, it's very much filtered through him.
Yeah.
So even though he is drawing from all these different influences, it's very much his interpretation of it. Mm. Whereas with someone like Edgar Wright, who I agree is a very, very talented director and has some bona fide areas of expertise, there are some times in some movies where it falls a little bit short. I mean, Baby Driver, for instance, I think is one. There's an opening sequence, and I think it's the credit sequence actually, where it's all sort of very beautifully choreographed. The music's fantastic.
Yeah.
And what's his name? Ansel Elgort, I think, cops a bit of flack these days, but I think he's actually really well cast in that. He's very graceful. Mm. He's a terrific physical actor, and it was great to see him go through that. But I don't really remember much about Baby Driver. No. I don't remember how it really resolves. I just remember...
Well, I think what you remember from Edgar Wright films are sequences, because he's really great at like action and just really clever, well-choreographed sequences. And Last Night in Soho is the same. Like, you know, he recreates London in the 60s and it is stunning. And there is a dance sequence you've probably seen in the trailer where... because this girl is sort of having visions of a previous life in the 60s. And so there's this dance sequence where it's the girl in the 60s and the present day girl dancing with Matt, what's the guy, Doctor Who?
Matt Smith.
Matt Smith.
Yeah.
And it is like it's breathtaking. Like you, it's almost like your eye can't believe what's happening. And I had to immediately go home and Google, like, how did they shoot that sequence? And it was all Texas switches. It was all done in camera. Okay. And the reason it is so, like, you're trying to work out how'd they do that? Because they actually did it. You know, it's not like they use like clunky CGI or anything. And so there's stuff like that. If films of his, the fight scene in World's End, you know, that pub fight scene where they're popping heads off those aliens. And it's all so exciting, but ultimately, the only film I've gone back to of his again and again and again is Shaun of the Dead. Now, I don't know if that's maybe the Simon Pegg element because, I don't know, Hot Fuzz is pretty good, but I feel that I'm still waiting for him to just come out with his, you know, perfect movie.
Yeah, likewise. I don't know if I used this term last time we spoke, but there's a line, it's attributed to the director Howard Hawks, or where he talks about what a movie needs is three good scenes, no bad ones.
Right.
And, you know, if you've got three good scenes and no bad scenes in your movie, then you've pretty much got a classic or something that people really, really enjoy. And I think that definitely applies to Edgar Wright. There are so many where you go, oh, remember that bit and that bit and that bit. Mm. But then you're sort of asked to think about the whole movie. It's like, didn't quite stick for me. I mean, yeah, I don't know, maybe they work better upon revisitation. I found that with World's End, it left me a little cold the first time I saw it. And then the next time I saw it, I'm like, oh,
yeah,
it's a bit of meat on the bone here.
Definitely, I think. And it's funny, there is value in going back to his films. Like he's a clever filmmaker, and each scene is like each shot is invested with so much storytelling in the production design and even the costume and all that kind of stuff. But I wonder, because I had the same experience with Scott Pilgrim, where I came out of it, you know, this is clever and cute. And I actually even had read the comics and, you know, thought it was a pretty good translation. But that was one of the movies where I felt like, I don't know that Michael Cera was the best choice. Like, it was in the summer of Michael Cera, and I understand that. And I'm not saying Michael Cera is a bad actor, but I just think in that role, I wanted someone a bit less wet. Maybe someone a bit more complicated, someone who's just had a different kind of persona. But then I watched Guillermo del Toro did a chat with Edgar Wright where he broke down the film, why it's a masterpiece. And after an hour of watching those two chat showing sequences from Scott Pilgrim, I'm like, well, clearly I'm the fucking idiot because it is a masterpiece.
Well, maybe you're not, Charlie, because I'm glad you mentioned Guillermo del Toro, because this might be a bit of, you know, fanboy blasphemy here, but he's a guy that a lot of people like, and justifiably so. But the more I think about the bulk of his body of work, the less impressed I am by it. I mean, his Spanish language movies, The Devil's Backbone and Pan's Labyrinth, I think they're both, you know, unimpeachable. They're fantastic. But even looking over like Blade 2 or Pacific Rim or Hellboy or Crimson Peak, I'm like, I should love all of these. And I walk away from going, could have been 25% better.
Well, it's a controversial introduction to the episode. I have named the entire works of Edgar Wright apart from Shaun of the Dead.
And now I'm imputing fanboy favourite Guillermo del Toro.
Well, he's on the supplementary list, I believe, right?
You can see the subscriber list of your challenges dropping.
Well, would you like to introduce your first film that you think could be 25% better?
Well, it's good that you started with Scott Pilgrim and Wright and Shaun of the Dead, because the title that sort of prompted all this was I was watching a movie called Club Dread.
Right.
It's an early 2000s movie, 2004, I think, by a comedy troupe called Broken Lizard.
Broke
out with Super Troopers a couple of years previously and didn't really do much beyond Club Dread. I think they had maybe two or three other movies, including Super Troopers 2, which I've yet to see, and one or two other bits and pieces, but they never really sort of broke out or took off. But watching Club Dread, I mean, it's a horror comedy, which are two great tastes that you think would, well, you hope would taste great together, but often do not mix as well as they should. Shaun of the Dead nailed it perfectly. American Werewolf in London did it really well. Tremors, which you mentioned on our last get-together, is a prime example of it. And Club Dread does not a bad job with it. I mean, I think it's got a terrific premise. It's set on this remote getaway tropical island that's run by a Jimmy Buffett-alike named Coconut Pete, played by the late, great Bill Paxton. Perfect casting. He's just in full scumbag mode. So it's got a staff made up of various lowlifes, vivacious young women and horny young dudes, essentially. And people start getting killed in gruesome, gruesome ways.
So is it, as well as being a horror comedy, is it a spoof of the slasher genre?
Sort of, but it's also plays it pretty straight. I mean, when it gets bloody, it gets bloody. And when it gets violent. But it also, it's one of those early 2000s raunchy dude sex comedies as well, which, you know, it doesn't really fly as well in 2021.
Before you got into the details of it, you said these are two tastes that should taste great together. But now that you explain what the tastes actually are, now that I know the ingredients, I'm like, yeah, but like bro frat sex humor with like super violent scenes actually sounds like an Eli Roth film, but without the comedy.
True. Yeah. Look, and there is a lot to like in it, certainly. The comedy is pretty funny, even though it is a bit sort of risque, raunchy, and a bit on the nose. And the horror is not exactly, it's not directed John Carpenter or Joe Dante style. It's competently, capably done.
Right.
So the horror is not horrific enough. The comedy is, it's okay.
Yeah.
So I think that's the reason that it's like, you're close. You're so close.
So what was it? Because I saw Super Troopers. That's the only broken loop. I think Beer Fest I saw as well, but I don't really remember anything about it. And I remember there was a lot of buzz around Super Troopers because Broken Lizard had built their name doing the college circuit and live shows and stuff. And I think they'd even crowdfunded part of Super Troopers, or there was some kind of fan element. And so there was a lot of buzz online about, you know, these kind of heroes who were like putting together this film. And they had that amazing, it wasn't a trailer, it was like a teaser scene, which is the guys who are, the young guys who are tripping on mushrooms and the cops flying past and then flying past in reverse. And I saw that and I'm like, oh, I am going to love this film. If it's all that, I'm going to love this film. But then I was like, it just felt fairly kind of like a fraternity comedy show. You know what I mean? I didn't love it enough to go, well, I have to see everything that the Broken Lizard do. Were you a huge fan of Super Troopers?
I enjoyed it a lot. Yeah. I mean, I think I actually interviewed the Broken Lizard guys when they came out to Australia to promote it. And they were all, you know, very affable and also very low-key ambitious. You could tell that they sort of had plans, well, beyond Super Troopers. They said, oh, we're making a movie next called Club Dread. I said, well, awesome title.
You said, you won't believe this, but in about 17 years, I'm going to be in a podcast talking about this film. What's a podcast?
I don't know. They struck me as well-intentioned, well-motivated guys, but never quite hitting it out of the park. Yeah, right. To use a baseball metaphor, I'm trying to think of other baseball terms that sort of like almost but not quite like a solid triple. Does that make sense?
I have no idea what that means.
No. It's,
home run, everyone understands. It's not quite a home run. They got run out at third base. I don't know.
I come up with a cricket analogy, but I know even less about cricket. I don't know about baseball.
Well, my next film is one that I feel 25% is harsh, but I can't really justify it saying it's a classic, and I've tried to sell it to people, but it's one of my favorite Kathryn Bigelow films, a movie called Strange Days, written by Kathryn Bigelow and James Cameron, her ex-husband, starring Ralph Fiennes and Angela Bassett. And the premise is it's the eerie future of 1997. And there was a phase.
No, actually it's 1999. It's the cusp of the millennium.
Cause it's New Year's Eve. That's right. Mm. And so, it was made in an era when, do you remember in the 90s, there was a bunch of films like sci-fis that dared to look 6 years into the future, is always like Predator 2 and stuff. It's always such a ballsy move to go, we're going to look 5 years in the future when fucking shit's real fucked up. And it's like, we'll remember that. Like, seriously, we'll be watching this on VHS and DVD when just after that comes out. It has one of the best opening sequences of a film I can remember, which is like it's a POV shot of a robbery taking place. And it's super exciting. It's these guys, you know, in a restaurant and they get to the safe and they're keeping all the staff hostage. The police come, they run up a set of stairs, they get to a rooftop, they don't know where to go. Suddenly they start fighting and it's really kinetic. And then one guy leaps to go to the next rooftop and falls to his death. Cut to Ralph Fiennes taking off this squid, which is this these electrodes you put on your helmet, because in the future, in the eerie future of 1999, will be able to record and download memories. So it becomes this black market trade where you can take the memories and experiences of other people and buy them. And it's such a great concept. Like it's that sort of Black Mirror. Oh yuck! Is this where technology is going to take us? And Catherine Bigelow, I mean, she seems to be mired in kind of like working with Mark, what's his name, the journalist, and everything. Mark Boll, and everything's like based on a true story. And I love The Hurt Locker. I think Zero Dark Thirty is actually a better film than Hurt Locker. But I do long for the days where Catherine Bigelow could come back and make just like a trashy action movie, you know. And it's really got some big concepts. And, you know, you're talking about scenes that you remember. Like there are so many... It also has brutal action because at one point, a rapper is assassinated and they need to find out who assassinated this rapper because they think it's going to trigger this huge riot on the eve of New Year's Eve, 1999. Mm. And so in Ralph Fiennes's, like, you know, he's this slimy ex-cop, you know, who's working in the black market, comes across all these experiences and there's, you know, there's rape and there's like murder and you're seeing it all from a first person perspective and you're actually, you know, experiencing the pleasure that the murderer experienced while they were like committing the act. And it's quite edgy and horrible. But then that's balanced out with some, like the actual climax of the film, the end of the film, which is this New Year's Eve party in, I don't even know what city it is. It must be Los Angeles.
It's LA, yeah. I mean, it's got that incredibly hopeful.
Yeah.
Finale, after all this.
And a very scary Vincent D'Onofrio, psycho cop Vincent D'Onofrio. But there's a shot in that in which they crane down from like a skyscraper through all this confetti and lights right down to the street. And again, it's 1999. Like they haven't quite mastered digital fly-throughs yet. So you have to imagine at least part of it was practical. And it's such a good film, but there's just something that, like, it has all the elements, it has all the pedigree. I think what it is, and I thought a lot about this, it's Ralph Fiennes.
I'm curious about that.
I think he was miscast because he's doing this American accent and it's kind of like when Ewan McGregor does an American accent. It's just like you can see the effort behind it and it sort of takes me out of the movie. And I also feel like Angela Bassett, who is that prototypical James Cameron heroine, you know, she's the ass-kicking mercenary. I just could not believe that she'd ever love this little wormy Nero. Like that something about that, because they don't play it as a love story, but they play it as, you know, she's his best friend who loves him.
Yeah, and she's also his conscience as well. Yes. I mean, I think she's seen the best of him when I think he was the cop on scene when her husband got arrested or something.
Right.
And he was, you know, really solicitous towards her kid and he was, you know, quite caring and sensitive. And she thought, well, look, this is a legitimately good guy who then sort of went off the rails a bit, became this black marketeer. It's almost a bit of a Big Trouble in Little China sort of scenario where the person you think is the sidekick is actually the hero.
Yeah, very much so.
It's very much Ralph Fiennes on the poster. He's kind of front and center because this is just post Schindler's List. Everyone's like, oh, this guy's the next big thing. Well,
if I could recast it, I would cast it with Edward Norton. Like Rounders era Edward Norton. I think Edward Norton does that kind of slime bag. There's something about a RADA trained actor playing a sleazy LA ex-cop. It all reads false. Like even if they had not made that part of his backstory, if he'd been like a record producer from London, you know, ex-cocaine addict, blah, 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 I would have bought it. But there's something about him... I don't know.
As a cop, yeah.
As a cop,
if he was Stock, Aiken or Waterman, yes, you could buy it.
So Aiken or Waterman. Yeah, you're right. I guess because he would have been coming hot off the back of Schindler's List and The English Patient, and it's like, well, we can get you Ralph Fiennes. Why wouldn't you? I mean, you're going to grab, he's like, you know, the hottest leading man going around. But I just feel like, that's what stops me from loving that movie.
I must admit, I was curious as to why this was on your list, and that actually makes perfect sense. I mean, Ralph Fiennes is a terrific actor, of course, but even the most terrific actors have parts that they're not necessarily right for.
Yeah. What's your next film, Guy?
Well, this is actually an actor who is right for a part, but the movie around him is just not that great. It's Passenger 57. It's a fantastic 1993
John
action
Cutter.
Movie, I believe. Starring Wesley Snipes as John Cutter.
Like, again, the 90s. I mean, there was an era where these kind of, it's Die Hard on a blank blank, were made. Yeah. And it felt like every hero's name was Jack or John something. And it was always like Jack Diamond, you know, John Muscle, you know, this real macho name, John Cutter.
You honestly can't get more macho than John Cutter.
Well, it's also very emo, like in a different context. If it was John Cutter, you're like, oh, poor guy. What's his issue? What's his trauma?
Sit down, John. Tell us about your childhood. But no, you won't get that from Wesley in Passenger 57, although he does have a bit of tragic backstory, I believe. I think his wife or his partner was shot in a convenience store holdup.
That's correct.
So, he's carrying around a few demons
and
working them out by way of capoeira. Wesley is very proficient in the Brazilian martial art. Well,
this was the first exposure we'd had to Wesley Snipes' action hero. It was kind of similar to Bruce, you know, in Die Hard, where it's like, wait a minute, the guy from Moonlighting, the quippy guy from Moonlighting is an action star? Like Jungle Fever, and I guess had White Men Can't Jump come out?
I think so, yeah. So, I mean, he showed some terrific physicality in that, but he hadn't done an action role prior to this. Yeah,
it's that hard-bitten action role as well, where he's like got, I mean, he has the most famous one-liner, you know, probably from the 90s.
You want to say it? Go and say it.
Always bet on black.
Always bet on black.
Which is such a great line.
Yeah, so Passenger 57 is, as you said, it's very much a Die Hard ripoff. It's Die Hard on not even an international flight. It's basically like a two-hour flight from some Midwest city to somewhere in the coast.
That is one of the remarkable things about it is you think, well, all right, so if the premise is so the world's most dangerous hijacker is getting flown somewhere on a plane.
What?
Yes. Just drive him. Like, it's in his bio. He's the world's most famous hijacker. And on the plane are a bunch of plants of his guys, and they take over the plane. And John Cutter is there because his mate Tom Sizemore has talked him into working airport security or something like that. What is it? Airport
Marshal? Tom Sizemore's showing up in a few things. Tom Sizemore's in Strange Days. Strange he's also Days. In this.
The worst. Yeah. Maybe it's another reason. He's got the terrible wig in Strange Days.
Oh, yeah. That is god-awful.
Stringy and gross. So Wesley Snipes is on the plane. And look, you know, this is there's quite a few films like not Under Siege. What's the one? Executive Decision.
Oh, yeah.
And Con Air, where the good guy on the plane is there, you know, playing cat and mouse to the bad guys. But it is remarkable on such a small aeroplane, like that the cat and mouse game takes long at all. And also, like the guy who's the actor who plays the villain, the main bad guy.
This is a guy named Bruce Payne.
Bruce Payne. He's excellent. Yeah. Like really over the top and hammy, like chewing some scenery like you wouldn't believe.
Oh, God, yeah.
But they sort of established
You've got Alan Rickman in Die Hard at one extreme who's very elegant, you know, but imbuing this guy with a bit of depth and a bit of class. And here's Bruce Payne as Bruce Payne as Charles Rain.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's why they cast him, because it rhymes.
Yeah, you know, and he is just gnawing the absolute hell out of the scenery. And he's, you know, he's got this incredibly sort of ice cold look about him, but also a beautiful early 90s mullet with a receding hairline at top. It's a fantastic look. I don't know if he's that much of an actor, but he's really, really good in this. Just a villain you'd love to hate, but the movie is generally just not good. It feels like it could have used maybe 10 million more bucks in the budget, an extra couple of weeks on the shooting schedule, and maybe another pass on the script. Let's get this out. Wesley's hot. Let's get this out there now.
Yeah. The action feels so clunky, especially by today's standards. Like, it's funny because my memory of it was, oh, shit, like Wesley Snipes can do martial arts. I had no idea. Like, this was sort of pre-Blade. And then I went back and watched some clips for it, and it was like, oh, like, it's kind of like your memory of Van Damme being like this awesome martial artist. And then you actually watch Van Damme films. It's like, well, he would put like two moves together at once. And you'd be like, whoa, like he's a martial artist. Like compared to what we see today, it actually looks really, really clunky.
Yeah. He's very light on his feet, and he's very graceful, very almost balletic, one might say.
It's
so,
kind of the way Patrick Swayze does action scenes.
Yeah,
I don't know if it's you that I mentioned it to, but I have people listen to Tofop will know that this one of my favorite things about Patrick Swayze in an action movie is that he'll do the most badass whatever in Roadhouse, you know, Showdown, but then when he saunters out of the scene, he's got that little dancer's walk where, like, you know, his toes are held together and his butt's all tight, and it's like, it doesn't matter how tough he looks in the fight scene, he always looks like a dancer when he exits.
I'll tell you what, I mean, I don't think I appreciated Patrick Swayze enough while he was around. And I'm thinking if he was still with us today, he would probably have that type of career that Liam Neeson has.
Mm.
That
well, he was heading that direction, wasn't he, with Black Dog and, you know, he was sort of moving into that kind of grumpy old middle-aged man.
I get the feeling he probably would have been a good sort of older ass-kicker type.
I reckon he's the kind of actor, a bit like last time we talked about Michael Keaton, you know, someone who was huge in the 80s and then sort of lulled a bit through the 90s.
Mm.
Definitely a director like Tarantino could have come along and just...
I think so, yeah.
Well, I guess with Donnie Darko, that was a bit of... We got a bit of Swayze charisma and very short scene. Like, I could see him doing little bits and pieces here and there, and then he gets his Birdman moment.
Absolutely. I mean, I think any actor, no matter how big they are, has that sequence where they're really quite big and then all of a sudden it's like, might be a bit sick of this guy.
Yeah.
You've seen enough Charlie Clawson for a while. Go take a break.
That's and then, why you know, I'm getting hired. Is it you? You're behind it all.
Damn it. My sinister plan. But, you know, 5 years from now, they're going to be like, you know who's good is that Charlie Clawson?
Yeah.
Let's put him in the Australian version of Nonstop or whatever.
Is that the Liam Neeson one, Nonstop? No.
That's the Liam, yeah. So it'll be you on the plane from Melbourne to Perth. That's 5 hours to get up to All Manner of Mischief.
Who directed Passenger 57?
It's a guy named Kevin Hooks.
Did he do anything?
I think he's done a lot of TV since.
Right. That makes sense. I could see him going into ER or something after this.
Yeah. I use this word a lot, but a competent director. I mean, he doesn't completely balls it up, but it's like, this could have used a little more juice.
Yeah. You know? Like, are you thinking sort of like a young Simon West or...
Something like that, yeah.
Rennie Harlan would have been out of reach at that stage.
Yeah, Rennie was in the midst of his cliffhanger days. So I think Rennie was, his quote was too high.
Yeah. All right. I have film.
One more thing.
Yes.
One more reason why I like Passenger 57. Just over the opening credits, just the funkiest theme tune.
Yeah. It's very cool.
Yeah, by a jazz musician named Stanley Clark. Just, you know, really slapping the bass in there. It's like, this is dope.
Next film I want to talk about, again, is a film that I'm really fond of and have actually gone back to rewatch. But for me, it's a structural thing, and it's the third act where everything falls away, and it's a little indie horror film called It Follows.
Right.
Now, the premise of It Follows is essentially a curse is an STD, basically. A girl, a teenage girl goes out on a date with a boy, they have sex, and then she wakes up, he's drugged her, and she's tied to a chair, and he's like, hey, really sorry, you've got the curse now. the best advice I can give you is have sex with someone else as quickly as you can, and then, you know, the curse will move to that person. And so the curse manifests itself as just eerie people walking towards you at a slow, steady pace. And it really is influenced by 70s horror. It's definitely got that John Carpenter vibe all over it with the score and the way it's shot. And then there's also a bit of John Hughes element where the teenagers feel very real. They're articulate but not precocious, and they're sort of hanging out trying to work out what to do. And it's such a cool premise because it you know, it's the deeper metaphor about, you know, it is kind of horrifying to think that death will come for us all. It's a slow, creeping thing, and it can take any form. You know, you all of a sudden you look up and this thing's coming towards you. And, you know, I have very
particularly clear, that young age as well.
Yeah, exactly. I have clear memories as a kid of like having recurring nightmares about being followed by someone where they just move at steady pace. It's that Mike Myers, Jason Voorhees kind of unstoppable force. Imagery.
Also a bit of George Romero zombie stuff in there as well. I mean, they're not running after, they're just shambling after you.
Yeah,
but there's plenty of them. And you have to stop sometime and eventually they're going to catch you.
And the great thing is, like, it's fairly low budget and there's no professor who opens up a book and explains, oh, this is the curse of the whatever, you know, blah, blah, blah. It's just the kids are working it out and you don't really even know what's going to happen if this demon or whatever it is gets its hands on them. It's just scary and they just run as soon as they see it. But then I feel like it all falls apart in the third act where the film kind of like whatever vague rules it's established around the curse or the demon, it completely just drops and turns into this really silly kind of like conventional horror film where they lay a trap for the monster and they shoot it with a gun even though they know it can't die and it's invisible sometimes and sometimes it's not. And it's just very confusing.
Confrontation at the pool, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, there's just, they set a trap for it where they're going to lure it into a pool and electrocute it. And it's like, but you have no knowledge that this will do anything to it. Like, you know, you said earlier, oh, you know, I know how to fix this film. I actually don't know how to fix it. But I did read an interview with Quentin Tarantino where he was talking about his favorite films of the year and it was the year It Follows came out. And he said, I loved that film, you know, it's got all the aesthetic things that he likes, but he goes, I wish they had just delivered on the premise. And I think that's exactly the issue, is like, it's such great visuals, great execution, great performances, great concept. And you just want that payoff at the end. And they just couldn't do it. They had to go back to their first act and go, okay, well, this is what we're saying in the first act. How do we mirror that in the third act? They didn't. They just said, let's just go to conventional ending. Having said that, the actual ending of the film is quite satisfying and makes sense, but it's how they get there, which is not. Sorry.
Yeah, but all the way through the film, I mean, like, I think you're really sort of enshrouded.
I'll take it.
By this mood that it's creating. And the filmmaker, David Robert Mitchell, I think is his name, is really adept at doing it. He does a fantastic job with that. And the actors as well. I think the actors do a terrific work.
Micah Monroe
is the lead, who went on to... She's in another terrific movie called The Guest. Have you ever seen that?
Yes. With the guy who looks like Tom Hardy? Is it the...
Yeah, Dan Stevens from Downton
Abbey. No, there's a different one. There's a guy, he was in Upgrade. It's an actor. I can't remember his name.
Oh, Logan Marshall.
Green. Yeah. Or something. He looks exactly like Tom Hardy. There's a film he's in that's about a guest somewhere.
Friends of mine call him Tom Hardley.
Poor bastard.
Well, I know. He's actually a really good actor.
I actually was talking to Lee Winnell just before Upgrade came out, and he said he nearly flipped when he saw the trailer for Venom. And it was Tom Hardy walking around hearing this like disembodied voice. He's like, God damn it. Now everyone's going to think I ripped off Venom.
And Venom's fun, but Upgrade is a much better movie.
Much better.
Yeah. What was that? Yeah, so you're watching It Follows, hopefully in a darkened cinema. Mm. Just, the mood's totally got you all the way through. But I think the 5 minutes after you've left the cinema, it's kind of like... just slips off you. You're like, okay, that was good. That was good while I was there.
Yeah.
Good at the moment, but it doesn't linger. I think
it's the Edgar Wright thing where it's like, oh, there's some really great sequences and, you know, clever ideas and stuff, but you're right. It's not one of those films that, you know, you would necessarily rush back to see because it's like, but you know what it is? It's a great calling card. You know, I think, you know, people could argue that the first Halloween, you know, well, it's not necessarily like a perfect film, but it's a great calling card for what John Carpenter could go on to do.
Yeah, and the way he closes that out as well, with just that final sequence of shot him, he's out the window. No, he's not there. And then just that terribly spooky stuff about these are all the places he was throughout the night.
The
breathing coming up. It's like that sticks with you after you leave.
Yeah.
And then you'll be half an hour later, be like... fuck. he's a pretty good filmmaker that I don't know him personally, but he's a good filmmaker.
That was his follow-up film.
Under the Silver Lake's an interesting one, isn't
really
it?
I think he's I hope he doesn't go the way of who's the guy who did Donnie Darko? Richard Kelly who just sort of disappeared, made a couple of films and then just hasn't done anything since.
Yeah, although Southland Tales, that second one that he made, is getting a bit of a two decades later on resurgence, as a lot of films like that do. They're so weird at the outset, and then, you know, a couple of decades on, it's like, oh wait, that was actually had a pretty good picture of what the world was like back then.
I think Donnie Darko is one of those rare examples of a film where when you see the director's cut, you're like, oh, no, the studio was right, because I feel like the original theatrical release, when it was like, let's just cut this to keep this to a good 90 minutes, is so much better than the director's cut where he changes the music and he puts more scenes in that don't actually improve the story at all.
That's the thing about, I mean, I think a lot of film nerds tend to treat director's cuts as like, oh, well, no, the true unfiltered vision. Mm. And I know a lot of the time it's kind of self-indulgent, even from really good directors. Mm. I mean, Michael Mann's director's cuts, some are good and some aren't all that great.
Yeah. And there was one that I really like is the Aliens director's cut, mainly because the century scene. I'm like, oh, that is so cool. But by the same token, I'm like, yeah, you could pull that out and it doesn't really affect. Yeah. And it makes it a much more like much more tight movie by pulling that scene out, because you're kind of always under the threat of the aliens coming in anyway. You don't need a scene specifically about them trying to get in the door.
Man.
What's your next film, right, Guy?
I get the feeling that I'm kind of straying from our original premise here, Charlie. Why? It means 25% isn't going to cut. It's more like these are premises that just don't deliver or have promise and don't follow through.
Okay.
This is an early 90s erotic thriller called Sliver.
Yes. Joe Esterhaz, Basic Instinct. The 90s, I mean, it's funny, the two films of Passage of 57 and Sliver, you've brought up two films that feel to me to be atypically 90s. The erotic thriller, I guess it is basically the Joe Esterhaz kind of, that was his, you know, playground. That's what he specialized in. But they don't make them like that anymore, do they? Or if they do, it's super contrived like 50 Shades.
Yeah, yeah. Although I think the head of Amazon or Amazon Prime, it was of a mind's like, remember those, you know, erotic thrillers we used to dig? We should bring those back. You know, you can watch those on a Friday night, just, you know, queue up Prime Video and, you know, and they've actually made one or two.
Okay.
There's one called The Voyeurs, which is kind of like Sliver, actually. It's got that whole peeping Tom element. You know, there's a kinky couple in the building next door who usually don't close their blinds. And, hey, we've got this telescope. Come on, why not? So, and Sliver kind of runs with that. The premise is, by the way, this is directed by Australia's own Philip Noyce.
Dead Calm fame.
Hot off Dead Calm.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So, okay. So we have Sharon Stone, who has just gone through a bit of a bad breakup. She is, so she's moved out of her old place and moved into a fancy new New York City apartment building, long, tall establishment, the Sliver of the title.
Right, there you go. That makes sense.
She's not looking for love. She's just looking to sort of regroup, get her life back together. But one of her neighbors is hunky Tom Berenger, who's a crime novelist and, I don't know, a bit of a horn dog. And the building owner is not Alec Baldwin.
Smoldering Billy Baldwin.
Smoldering Billy Baldwin, hot off Backdraft from a few years earlier. So what you've got here is you've got a convergence of talents on the boil. You've got Sharon Stone from Basic Instinct, Billy Ball from Backdraft, Tom Berenger. I think he won an Oscar for Platoon a couple of years earlier.
Did Philip he win Noyce an was, Oscar?
Was he nominated?
He would have been nominated. Mm. Yeah.
Okay, nominated.
No, maybe he is an Oscar winner. I just would have thought I'd know if Tom Berenger. Google it quickly. I'll do it. You talk, I'll Google. Okay.
a good combination, the delegation of duties. And Joe Esterhaz, who was just churning out erotic thrillers hand over fist, so to speak.
You're right. Tom Berenger won the supporting actor for Platoon. I can't believe I didn't know that.
Oh, nice. I thought it was the case, but he didn't really capitalize on it all that much. Someone said the other day, and when I say the other day, I mean like months ago, but it's stuck with me. Because you don't really want to recast anyone in Die Hard other than Bruce Willis, although a lot of people were on the list before Bruce Willis. But someone said, you know who would have been really good as John McClane is Tom Berenger.
Yeah. Well,
and he sort of had that blue-collar kind of thing going for him.
Yeah.
And it looks like he could, it looks like he could fuck someone up.
Well,
so,
all those Die Hard films, Die Hard and all those knockoffs, Passenger 57, all based on books, I believe. And they're all those hard-boiled. And it's always about a middle-aged alcoholic cop who's, divorced and blah, blah, blah. And you're right, Tom Berenger has that. While we're doing fantasy casting, I always thought in the 90s, when Michael Keaton stepped away from Batman, I thought Tom Berenger would have been perfect as Batman. Don't you reckon he has that kind of imposing, he's good looking enough to be Bruce Wayne and looks damaged.
Yeah.
But then when he's in the suit, like he could be definitely intimidate criminals.
Yeah. And he's certainly got the jawline for it and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. I mean, the fact that Tom Berenger didn't really break a bit bigger.
Yeah. It's
a bit of an odd one,
it?
Really.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember seeing Sliver on VHS and, being very excited because it's like, well, we're going to see Sharon Stone nude again. And it was probably the first time in my teenage boy life that I was ever bored by sex scenes. Like, yeah. it wasn't sort of titillating. What didn't have that Verhoeven kind of like in your face titillation. They were obviously trying for something a bit more elevated, dare I say a bit more European, but the whole thing is just so dull.
Yeah, I mean, Verhoeven's a guy who really clearly revels in sex scenes. I think I saw something the other day where he was, I think it might be on the 4K Basic Instinct that just came out, but he did these very elaborate sketches showing how he wanted to choreograph the Michael Douglas Sharon Stone sex scene.
Like a fight scene.
And they're
scene.
Pretty explicit. So, I mean, yeah, it's like, I wouldn't be surprised if he took these home and framed them because they're, you know, very graphic.
That's amazing. And
Philip Noyce, as good a filmmaker as he is, he doesn't seem to have that kinkiness in him. Yeah, so... Yeah, what you get with Sliver is just a bunch of people who aren't really on the same page and don't really have a lot of chemistry. Baldwin and Stone certainly don't. I mean, the one good thing it's got going for it, I mean, yeah, the sex scenes are kind of boring, but at least one of them is the soundtrack is Unfinished Sympathy by Massive Attack.
Oh, yeah, like, right.
And look, I'm sorry to get a little bit gross and graphic here, but... At some stage when I was getting intimate with, well, hopefully getting intimate with a lady in the 90s, I tend to have a bit of Massive Attack on the stereo just in case.
A Sliver taught me one thing. Well, I'm glad it wasn't the perving on your neighbors thing. You took the right lesson from Sliver.
Dude, I was in Geelong at this stage. You don't want to be looking in your neighbor's windows.
Yeah, when Verhoeven does it, like, he's doing it for a reason. There's a reason why stuff looks so glossy and why the sex is wild and why the scenes are violent and stuff. But then in sort of lesser 90s director's hands, it just comes across looking like an elevated commercial.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Verhoeven, I think, revels in it, but he's also got he's taken the piss a little bit. And I think people following his footsteps or aping that kind of thing are just like, is this sexy?
Is this sexy? Yeah. Hot tip. So, if you have to ask, probably not.
It ain't. Yeah. So I think Sliver's a great concept. And I mean, I think you could probably turn it into a good Amazon or Netflix series about sexual shenanigans in this apartment building with people who have got various kinks. They're interacting. They don't really know each other, but maybe they do. You've got this voyeur building owner who's checking in on everybody and maybe exploiting that for his own means. I think he could turn that into a really cool series.
Yeah, I was wondering if it, like, how it would translate now. Like, it seems so archaic, the idea of, like, ooh, like cameras everywhere. It's like, yeah, fucking hell, man. We carry them in our pockets every day.
Well, yeah,
like, we have our laptops have cameras in them. Like, who cares? I just don't know if it would have that same kind of, ooh, this is like creepy and forbidden. It's like, well, people post shit on TikTok all the time when they're half naked.
Very valid point.
The next film I want to talk about is another film that I actually genuinely really like. And I think when I first saw it, that was when I was really at the, oh, this is 25% wrong. But then I have maybe credited a few more percentages, but I still I still don't think it's what I want it to be. And that's Alex Garland's Annihilation. So Alex Garland, right, coming off Ex Machina, you know, super smart. You know, he likes hard sci-fi, that's clear. And so Annihilation is based on a novel or a series of novels, I believe.
Yeah, I think it might be more than one novel by Jeff Noon. Is that right?
I'm not sure. Yeah. But I think, from what I understand, the films do not have that much to do with the novels. But the basic premise is Natalie Portman is a military doctor of some kind. She's a soldier who's also a doctor, scientist. And this phenomenon, like a meteorite or something, lands in this, you know, stretch of jungle, and this little bubble forms around it. And so her husband, Oscar Isaacs, has gone into this thing with his team and has gone missing. But then he comes back and has this kind of, like, his body breaks down. And so she is sent in to find out what happened to him while he was in there. And so they get a ragtag group of scientists together, including Tessa Thompson and
an all-female team that goes in.
Yep, they all go in. And it is such a beautifully disconcerting science fiction film, because once you are in this bubble, just as light is distorted coming through like a bubble, everything, the DNA of things is distorted once you're in the bubble. Yeah. And so there's elements of kind of sci-fi, there's elements of horror, body horror. It has some two of the most unnerving horror scenes I can remember. The one where they go into the swimming pool and they find the body that's sort of been absorbed by the plants. And there's something about that that just makes my skin crawl, that kind of body horror, the idea that a plant could grow out of you or something like that.
Oh, yeah.
And then there's the death bear, the dead bear. Oh.
That bear.
Yeah, which moans, half human, half bear. It's such a – but I remember when I saw the film, I was actually in LA and I saw it with my mate Greg and we went to a late night screening. And I think because I'd been in LA and I'd been reading a lot of scripts and watching a lot of kind of mainstream stuff, that when I sat down to watch it, I was expecting a kind of – you know, a fairly conventional science fiction film. But this is
a women on a mission movie.
Yeah. But this
a bit
is
like a bit, Aliens, really.
Yeah, something. Exactly. But this is a bit more art house, and it's all about destruction, the cycle of of life, you know, inevitably has destruction, and that is the kind of metaphor. But spoilers for Annihilation, the ending, when she finally confronts the alien or whatever the force is, it's this kind of interpretive dance-off with this kind of like mannequin. And, you know, on one hand, I'm like, okay, yeah, that I like the fact that you didn't take the It Follows route and just go, well, here's a conventional ending. She straps bombs to the UFO and it blows up and it's a happy ending. Alex Garland went for something a bit more cerebral. But I didn't find it.
Although we did throw in an explosion there as well.
Oh, yeah, there's an explosion.
Or a couple of explosions.
Yeah, there are explosions, but it's...
But even then, they're kind of weird psychedelic explosions where it's I don't know if this is destroying anything. I think this is just rearranging matter.
Yeah, the whole film is very psychedelic. Like, I can recommend seeing it quite baked. It does...
Absolutely.
Because the other thing about it that is probably my favorite thing, the most lasting thing, is the soundtrack, which is Ben Salisbury and Jeff Barrow, who have done a lot of Jeff Nichols films as well. They did Take Shelter. Cool. And that's a different person. But they did the Black Mirror soundtrack as well. But it is such a beautifully haunting soundtrack. And I think it's one of those soundtracks where you can listen to it and imagine almost what the film could have been rather than the film you saw.
Yeah, look, I'm trying to do my calculations in my head here and figure out how Annihilation could be 25% better, because it's been a while since I've seen it, but the first time I watched it, I'm like, this is unusual and I am here for it. And a few times I've revisited it since then, I'm like, yeah, there's a lot going on here. I'm not sure I get it.
No.
But I want to get it.
Yeah.
And I might keep coming back until I get it, and maybe that interpretation is going to be different every time because I'll be different every time.
Yeah, and I think it's also like the danger you run into if you give a real sort of straight ahead ending is it's the contact phenomenon where it's like, oh, it's a fucking dad, you know, like it's mawkish or no explanation.
We can't show you what really happened. It's going to blow your mind. Yeah. It's like you couldn't come up with anything, could you?
Speaking of Jeff Nichols, and we talked about Midnight Special last time you're on the show. That to me is an ending, which initially I'm like, ah, come on. But then I'm like, well, you know
I'll
what?
Take Shelter?
Midnight Special. Midnight Special. The ending of Midnight Special, where they finally get the alien kid where he needs to go. And I'm like, at first I was like, what is this shit? But in retrospect, I'm like, oh no, this is kind of clever. Like whatever this thing, if it's an alternate dimension, if it, you know, whatever we're looking at, it's kind of not the E.T. ending. It's not the Starman ending. Like he tried to do something different. And I think that Alex Garland, you know, like his track record speaks for itself. I just finished Devs, which I thought was really, really great as well. And I think that he is more comfortable asking questions
providing answers.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, the ending of Annihilation is very, I guess, ambiguous.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're like, is this the same Natalie Portman who went in? Is it a different one who came out? What's the deal with Oscar Isaac? I mean, I think he's definitely a different person. So what's the relationship between these two like now? I love an ending like that. I mean, one of the best endings of a film in recent years is Whiplash.
Mm.
The drummer one?
Yeah.
Because you just leave that going, well, holy shit, what's the relationship between these two now?
Yeah.
You know, and Damien Chazelle's not going to tell us. He's just leaving it at the, you know, with the last drop of the drumsticks. Like, I'm going to be thinking about this for a while.
Yeah.
I guess that's the same to some degree with Annihilation.
Well, that's
You've got me thinking I want to revisit it now.
Yeah, it definitely was with me because I remember I walked out of the cinema with my mate and I was just like, that sucked. And what did that mean? And he was like, are you kidding? Mm-hmm. Like the world, it was all about the world being in the world. And I could not stop thinking about it for the next like week or so. The music was in my head. So I had to listen to the soundtrack 100 times. And then I started thinking more about, well, what does this actually mean? And, you know, the fact that her husband had disappeared and she'd had that affair, is that sort of suggesting that, you know, she's driven to destruction? Yeah. And so, you know, was she consciously going into that bubble, you know, because she was self-destructive, or did she destroy herself and has she been reborn? Have they both been, you know? So I think that's a good sign. That's a sign of a good film, but it's still.
There's a lot of meat on the bone, as I like to say. Yeah. And there's a lot to sink your teeth into.
But it's not perfect. And that's what we're talking about. Films that aren't perfect.
Be more perfect, Annihilation, for goodness sakes. Well, speaking of movies that are not perfect, I'm going to go to my final one.
You've got two to go.
Oh, that's my apologies. Sorry.
Your penultimate one.
My penultimate one. Oh, golly, I'm getting ahead of myself here. This is a movie from the late 80s, I believe 1988, called Dead Heat.
Now, I knew nothing about this film, and I've just been on IMDb, and all right, what the fuck is going on with this film? What's going on with the premise? What's going on with the cast? What is this film?
I really like this premise. Dig this. Two cops are investigating a weird series of robberies that appear to be being perpetrated by people who can't be killed. They finally put enough bullets into one of them to take one down, take him off to the morgue. The coroner says, this guy's already had an autopsy. What's going on here? They go to some weird science lab that the guy has some links to. One of our cops gets killed. He has 24 hours to solve his own murder and the mystery before he dissolves into a pile of goo. If you ask me, that's a great premise. I'd be very happy to watch this movie. I'd be very happy to watch this movie if they threw a few more millions of dollars at the budget, if they had a little more time to shoot, and if they cast one of the leading roles with an entirely different person.
Now, can I guess? So the two stars are Treat Williams and Joe Piscopo, Saturday Night Live's Joe Piscopo. Joe Piscopo, who is probably the pop culture touchstone for the guy who leaves a successful show because he thinks he's going to make it big in movies and then does Dead Heat. So of those two guys that you want to recast, let me, knowing how much you love the movie Deep Rising, let me. So it's Joe Piscopo, right? He's miscast.
He's got to go. Joe Piscopo has got to go. Got to go.
I mean, the guy's probably rapped that there's people talking about him on a podcast.
You'd think so. Look, he was on SNL for a while, appeared alongside Eddie Murphy a lot. I think they had a recurring sketch where Joe was Frank Sinatra and Eddie played Stevie Wonder.
Right.
And yeah, they were a pretty good team. Eddie, of course, goes off, does movies, becomes Eddie Murphy. Joe Piscopo goes and does Dead Heat. But in the interim, he hits the gym and maybe some other substances as well because he is ripped. Jack. Yes, and he is not afraid to show it off. He's wearing that T-shirt you were wearing the last time we did the podcast, Charlie. One that shows off the guns.
Yeah.
But he's like legitimately flexing in the middle of scenes. It's just off-putting.
Yeah.
And on top of that, he's doing, all due respect to Ryan Reynolds, he's doing that Ryan Reynolds thing where he's just riffing.
Quippy.
All the time.
Yeah.
Yeah, just quippy. And you can tell a lot of them are off the cuff. And quite frankly, those cuffs need cleaning because, you know, these jokes are just shit.
Yeah.
So meanwhile, you've got Treat Williams, who is underplaying, but got a really good droll sense of humor, a very appealing actor to watch. And he's doing a really good job, but he's just burdened with, sorry, Joe, this fucking lummox.
Yeah.
So what you think would be like a supernatural lethal weapon kind of deal, a good buddy cop movie with a weird sort of horror element. It just doesn't really play out that well because you only care about one half of the team.
So is it just the casting that squandered it, or is there other elements?
Oh, I think the script could use another pass. It's actually written by a guy named Terry Black, Shane Black's brother, who wrote Lethal Weapon.
Although
I don't think he...
A buddy cop.
Yeah. He's like, Shane's doing all right. Shane.
Well, I guess Wesley Snipes is wrong. It seems in this instance you should never bet on Black. Or only sometimes bet on Black. Thank you.
Well done, Mr.
Clawson. It was a long way to get to that one joke. We've had many dropouts in this podcast recording that people will never know about, but we got there in the end. You got more
to say? No. So yeah, it's just a premise that fails to live up to its promise.
My final film is one that I was conflicted about bringing up because it is, you talk about guilty pleasures. This is a great, fun movie with two leads kind of at the peak of their powers. And it is a lot of fun, but I feel like it could have been an absolute classic rather than a punchline. And that of course, is Tango and Cash, starring Kurt Russell and Sylvester Stallone. Kurt Russell and Tango are two mismatched buddy cops who are forced to work together to solve, I don't fucking know, something. They go to jail. They work out that they're better teaming up. No, that's sorry. There's the final scene is them high-fiving, right? It's a freeze frame on a high-five. Yeah. Of course.
Yeah. And then pull out, and that's like the front page of
the
newspaper.
The front page of the newspaper.
Tango and Cash are back.
That's right, because the citizens of whatever city this in really need to know the ins and outs of the two cops. Talk about miscasting. Like when you've got Kurt Russell and Sylvester Stallone, and you need to cast one as the kind of elegant gentleman, kind of intellectual. Like, who are you going for? Like, it's so strange that they cast he's Italian, so I get the fact that he likes nice cars and nice things and nice suits and stuff. But when he opens his mouth, he does not sound like the smart one.
No. They're sort of presenting him as this guy who, he dresses in three-piece suits. He makes a shit ton of money on the stock market. His own boss says, dude, you don't need to be a cop. Why are you doing this? He goes, I like action.
Yeah.
And so, and meanwhile... It's a form. Kurt Russell's Cash is this beer for breakfast slob.
Yeah, they ripped this film off wholesale for Shaw and Hobbs. I mean, it's the exact same dynamic.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
It's the exact same bickering. There is a love interest in the middle. They make it a sister in Hobbs and Shaw, whereas this one, it's like, no, it is a sister.
No, Terry Hatcher's Stallone's sister.
Stallone's sister. So it's exactly the same.
It really is.
It really is the same film. Although I hated Hobbs and Shaw, whereas Tango and Cash...
I did not like it at all.
Tango and Cash has one of the best prison break sequences gone round. Like, it's genuinely exciting, and it feels like... That's, I think, the promise is the best action sequence is in the second act, when it needs to be in the third act. The third act, it's so disappointing, because they actually... It's fun, and the banter's good, despite the weird casting, and you really like... And Kurt Russell is just charisma machine. You go with...
Absolutely. It. But they've got really good chemistry, these two, which I was kind of surprised by. And I mean, I would have liked to have seen further adventures of Tango and Cash.
But don't you think Kurt Russell could have chemistry with anyone, though? He strikes me as that kind of guy.
Little bit, doesn't he?
Yeah, I think...
The thing of it is, he's the second choice for this because, and we mentioned this guy earlier, Patrick Swayze was really going to be Cash.
Really? See, Patrick Swayze should have been cast in the Stallone role. I mean, I could see Patrick Swayze playing like... I mean, he drives a Mercedes in Roadhouse. Like, he's already got the trappings of an elegant man. I think that you... No disrespect to Sly, but if you're going to recast anyone... You recast Sly and you bring in a Patrick Swayze or someone of that ilk. And I think it's still a really good film. Although there is something about those beefed up action sequences where you want that kind of dumb lug just throwing punches and...
You do.
Yeah, right.
And look, it's a bit of, I don't know, against typecasting having Stallone as the sophisticate.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's kind of how he views himself in real life as well. I mean, I think he views himself as a bit of a Renaissance man.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's that, you can find it on YouTube because there's this, he did a director's cut, speaking of director's cuts, of Rocky IV.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And he's like, when I made it, I was really influenced by MTV and it was all cut, cut, cut. And I lost track of the themes and all this stuff. It's like, dude, you're talking about Rocky IV here. But this is really interesting. It goes for about 90 minutes or so, and it's him in the editing room saying, the whole Rocky movies are about the Warrior's Code and all this kind of stuff. And it's classic Stallone in that half of it is this guy's a lot smarter than a lot of people giving credit for, and half, this guy's a total bozo.
Yeah. I mean,
but that's still on YouTube and definitely worth looking at if you're interested in Stallone.
No, I'd love to.
It really does paint an interesting picture of him as someone who's got a lot of stuff going up on stairs, but maybe not quite as much as he thinks he has.
I don't think you can have as long a career as he has in Hollywood if you're dumb. Like, he's smart
that's
enough
true.
To have written the first Rocky and then smart enough to know that he needs to be a writer and producer or director and producer from then on. I mean, The Expendables are terrible movies, but the brain, the idea behind it is smart. Like, he knows his genre. And I think that maybe that's the failing of Tango and Cash, is that maybe with a different director or a different star, you could have had a better final act, because in the final act, it's just they go see their version of Q. They get tooled up in this armored vehicle with all these like machine guns. And then it's just incoherent.
A lot of shit blows up, that's it.
Yeah, meaningless action, and then there's a showdown with Jack Palance, who, you know, chewing the scenery, doing what Jack Palance does, but it all feels for naught. And it's a shame, because I feel like it could be up there with, I mean, I think even like films like Commando are sort of held in a higher esteem because they know what they are and they go for it. Whereas at some stage, Tango and Cash goes, oh, we're just going to become a bit of a hard-bitten kind of like action movie thriller here when we go to prison. And then it's nowhere comedy again. And then it's the end. It's like, well, we just fuck it. Can we just blow something up?
Yeah, because, I mean, there are so many good buddy cop comedies around that era. I mean, with A Lethal Weapon, Running Scared with the Dream Team of Billy Crystal and Gregory Hines.
Gregory Hines.
That's a fantastic cop movie. And, I mean, if Tango and Cash had that degree of wit and energy, you'd be singing its praises today, as opposed to saying, be 25% better.
Well, we've only got one film to go. Guy, bring us home. What is it?
This is a movie that I won't say renowned, perhaps kind of disrespected for enjoying as much as I do. It's the penultimate movie so far by the great John Carpenter. It's 2001's Ghosts of Mars.
Well, I think according to everything that John Carpenter said publicly, it's his final film. I don't think he's coming back. He likes being a rock star now.
Yeah, he made one other movie after this called The Ward, not a lot of people have seen. But Ghosts of Mars is very much in the John Carpenter vein. It's basically a remake of his early film Assault on Precinct 13, but on Mars with ghosts. The police force have gone out to some. It's also Carpenter apparently very much wanted to direct westerns when he started his career. He was like, you know, if I could just be a studio guy who makes westerns, that's great. I'd love to do that. He never really got the opportunity, but he snuck a lot of Western themes and motifs and all that kind of stuff into his horror movies, his action movies, whatever. And this is very much that case. You've got a posse of cops going out to detain a criminal who's been found at a mining colony. It's Ice Cube as the weirdly named Desolation Williams. What kind of nickname is Desolation? Nicknames are meant to be punchy, catchy.
An MMA fighter, Desolation, too many syllables.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, Wasteland Williams, call him that.
Yeah, there you go, perfect.
There you go. John Carpenter, call me. Yeah. Let's do. They get there and discover that the miners have been possessed by the ghosts of the original inhabitants of Mars who want their planet back. But the cops are like, you know what? Fuck it. We're colonists. We're colonializers. It's our planet now. Bang, bang. So how do you bang, bang against ghosts? I don't know. So a lot of holes in this, as one can discern. The thing of it is, I don't know how true this is, but this is meant to be like a third Snake Plissken adventure.
All right.
You had Escape from New York, Escape from LA, and then you had Escape from Mars. Kurt Russell was supposed to be in it. I think he took a look at the script and said, John, I think I might pass and go do something else. Anything else? The studio said, you know who's hot is Ice Cube. Let's bring him in. Courtney Love was apparently meant to play the main cop. She either got hit by a car or busted her ankle or something prior to shooting. They brought in Species star Natasha Henstridge, who clearly didn't have a lot of time to study the action sequences because she's going through the motions. I kind of love this movie, but at the same time, I kind of hate myself for loving this movie. It is ridiculous. It's got a dumbass heavy metal soundtrack. The cast is all over the shop. It does have Pam Grier in it, who does a pretty good job. Also, an early role from Jason Statham as like an intergalactic sex pest who keeps hitting up Natasha Henstridge all the time. It's really uncomfortable to watch. So I don't know. I get the feeling if you recast it, primarily if you recast it and maybe, again, throw a few million of the budget to liven up the special effects a bit, it would probably work. But, yeah, it's one of those, going back to what I was saying at the start, this is the very definition of a guilty pleasure for me. It's like, I enjoy this so much, but gosh, you could be better. you could have done a little, put in a few more of the hard yards.
I never saw Ghosts of Mars because from all my friends who'd seen it, they said it doesn't feel like a John Carpenter film because it doesn't have the Carpenter music. And there's this sort of like, the action is kind of perfunctory. It feels like someone doing like a ripoff of John Carpenter, but not even doing a good one.
A little bit, yeah. I mean, he's usually renowned for his shot composition and his staging and all that. And a lot of the action in this is just, okay, I'm locking down the camera, run into the scene, biff, pow. And it's not necessarily that thrilling.
I read something online that he was saying it was an intentionally meant to be bad, which is maybe the Tommy Wiseau defense, you know, which is like, yeah, I was trying to make a ridiculous action film. It was meant to be, everything was meant to feel ridiculous and stupid and over the top, which I think is probably a good a time as any to sort of, you know, maybe call time or at least say, I've got one more film in me. When you're getting to
that's when you retire to the couch, you collect royalty checks, you play video games, smoke weed, and occasionally go out and play your soundtracks for adoring crowds, which is what he's doing these days. He's living the life.
Oh, yeah. It seems like every interview I've seen with him recently, it's like he has such disdain for not only like the film industry, but the people who seem to revere him. He's like, he does not, he has no time for questions about Halloween and the deeper psychoanalysis of Mike Myers. It's like, I don't fucking care. He's like, they just give me a paycheck. That's all I know. Yep. It's like, he's got the Harrison Fords about him.
And look, I kind of admire that. I mean, the man gave us a shit ton of good movies over a couple of decades. I think he's entitled to put his feet up.
Yeah, go bloody play some rock and roll shows, John. Guy, thank you.
Bring it down under while you're at it.
Yeah, definitely. Well, when I saw Annihilation, that was when he was touring, and I actually was going to go see John Carpenter, and I didn't get to see it in the end. It's one of my... I didn't know fucking COVID was coming. I didn't know. None of us knew, Guy.
None of us saw COVID coming.
Guy, thanks so much for coming back on the show. It's such a treat, and I can't wait to get you back on. I'll have to steal some more of your online content to use as my own podcast. So I'll keep my eyes on your Twitter account. Where can people find you on Twitter?
You can find me at Robert Guy Davis. And if you're interested in hearing more of my dulcet tones, Charlie mentioned the name of that podcast earlier, Four Finger Discount for all your Simpsons needs.
We'll put a link in the episode description for people who want to listen.
Sorry about that, muscling in and sort of shilling my own.
No, I was about to give you the floor, but you did my job for me, so it's good. We'll get you back on. Think about some more films that we can talk about because I genuinely love doing this. I'm Charlie Clawson.
I'm Guy Davis, and we'll do this again sometime in the near future.
I think we need a snappier finish.